live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Mark Casello, Art Sear, John Kochelko, and David Masiultra. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a comment, it is at btbdumont, at BTB Dumont. We're going to begin the broadcast this evening, as we have for several weeks now, talking about the situation in Ukraine, Crimea, and also the situation involving the United States and Russia and the showdown with the West and Vladimir Putin. Bob Corker from Tennessee was on one of the television shows today, and Senator Corker said that in describing our situation and describing what's happening in Ukraine and U.S. policy towards the Ukraine, is that he really thinks that, we're not, he didn't use the term leading from behind. He just said he thought the Russians were playing us, that we were being played. John Kochelko, do you think we're being played by the Russians at the moment?
Well, I think the Russians recognize that we have a very weak and ineffectual leader, and I think that Putin is a very strong and forceful leader who's determined to expand Russia's territory, its power and influence, and to do whatever is necessary. And he's going to continue pushing. He's going to continue, I think, stirring up trouble in any province that he thinks is winnable for the Russian Federation.
Art Sear, do you think we're being played?
I think there's a good chance of that, and I think the President and Secretary of State are aware of that, which is why they've been so cautious. Given all the criticism in an election year of the Obama administration, it's important to keep in mind that Russian interventionism predates Obama's tenure. In 2008, there was a much more overt Russian military invasion of Georgia. Much worse for us, because the Bush administration, full of boasters, starting with President Bush, had been beating their breasts about getting Ukraine and Georgia in NATO. Fortunately, that didn't happen. Despite their rhetoric, when the invasion occurred, they did nothing. I mean nothing. At least we're trying to mobilize the European Union and NATO. I do think Germany's role is crucial, and we should discuss that.
We'll come back to that. Right. David Masiultra, also. David, nice to have you with us. You've been on the show a couple of weeks ago, and my question to you is, as you're probably the youngest person at the table this evening, as you look at this issue, is there anything that your generation would want the president to be doing more than he is doing?
On the Russian issue?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think that my generation is very averse to any foreign involvement. American history has a tendency for correction and even overcompensation. The voting public tends to react to the previous president, and President Bush was an interventionist. He was very aggressive. You know, he started a war in Iraq, unnecessary one. The public reacted quite unfavorably to it. And now the American public, I would say, is perhaps overcompensated by having an adverse reaction to even the slightest indication of any foreign involvement.
Mark Casello also joins it. Mark, you've been on this program. You're representing the political left, generally speaking. Do you think that there's been an overreaction by the president in this particular case? Are we making too much of this situation?
Well, what's gotten lost in the conversation recently is a lot of emphasis is placed on Putin himself and vilifying Putin. But the agreement that was reached earlier between the G8, between the force of NATO, well, it was G8, and Putin was to the economic bailout of Ukraine, the original agreement that was reached between Putin and the European Union was a good one, and then we let a democratically elected leader be ousted by a public revolution. And I think that's one of the biggest parts of this that's gotten kind of thrown under the bus in this discussion, is that America in Egypt and now here in Ukraine has been backed into a corner of sort of supporting pro-Western forces who aren't necessarily democratic in how these changes of power.
John, do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly don't agree that we permitted a so-called elected leader to be overthrown. I'm not sure the United States played any part in the overthrow of the Ukrainian president. His election was highly questionable. There are those who believe that in a free and fair election that the pro-Western forces would have a majority and did at the last election, but that the election was stolen in typical old-fashioned Soviet style. So, no, I don't believe that. I think that the people of the Ukraine have a right to determine their own disposition in foreign policy, whether they want to be aligned with NATO or the European Union or the U.S., and they shouldn't have Vladimir Putin having a veto.
But with all the discussion that's been going on for the last month, a lot of Americans probably are asking themselves, is this in our national interest? The president doesn't seem to have made a real strong case that this is in our national interest. It's a horrible thing that's happening. We're going to have some sanctions. But do you think the average person on the street, Art, thinks that this is somehow a huge issue for the average American?
I think Americans are more sophisticated than academics especially give them credit for. Yes, I think people are generally aware of this. They don't want to go to war, as indicated, and polls are clear on that, but it's an extremely worrisome situation, and the sense of concern, that starting with the President and the Secretary of State, we've expressed is important. This is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War, which destroyed the world as people knew it, literally, as people knew it at that time, politically and diplomatically.
Is there a similarity between the start of World War I and what's happening now?
Yes, in the sense
intense
nationalisms in Eastern Europe, especially the Balkans, borders don't respect ethnic boundaries in the same way that they do in Western Europe, and they're not nearly as well-established over the long term. Historically and currently, diplomatic effectiveness is crucial, which is why I mentioned Germany.
John?
I think this is a replay not of World War I, but of the 1930s. This is the Sudetenland crisis all over again. This is an aggressive and expansionist power stirring up trouble in a neighboring country, using the population of a border province, stirring up trouble there, and then marching in, claiming it's protecting an oppressed minority. We even had the equivalent of a Munich agreement this week. We had John Kerry, and we had the European Union and Putin sitting down and signing off on the government of the Ukraine, much as Chamberlain and Daladier and Mussolini and Hitler did, decided the fate of Czechoslovakia. The only difference was that John Kerry didn't wave the little piece of paper over his hand and say that he had secured peace in our
didn't
time.
Lie.
And it's falling apart. It's already falling apart.
Correction, please. The Munich Agreement involved ceding territory to Nazi Germany. Our administration, the EU and NATO, have done no such thing.
What happened to Crimea? What happened to Crimea? Wasn't that territory not ceded but taken by the Russians?
You were drawing an analogy between the meeting last week and Munich. You keep changing the goalposts.
Territory's already been taken.
And you keep changing the goalposts.
Oh, no, I'm not changing the
goalposts. They took Crimea arbitrarily, and it was not sanctioned by the United States.
Go ahead, finish your point.
It was not sanctioned by the United States in the sense of acceptance or any European country.
And
this is an extremely important point. In high school debate many years ago, part of the conventional wisdom was the team that mentions Hitler first is the team that loses.
You know, Art, I stopped.
Just finish my point without being interrupted.
Sure, no, you can't because we've got to go to a break. But when you come back, everybody can finish his statement and we'll let everybody get involved in it. 1-800-723-8800.
Rude interruption is very, very contrary to effective discussion.
Art, we're going to a break. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. As we went off to go to a commercial break, we got into a little spat between two of our guests. One was accusing the other of interrupting them, and I think there were some factual points, but I think the last person who spoke was you, Art. So, John Kochelko, you took exception to something that Art was saying.
Well, yeah.
He took exception to what you were saying. So let's...
I suppose, you know, when you have strong views, that sort of thing sometimes happens. But, you know, you raised the analogy to World War I, and I didn't object to that. But I raised the analogy to World War II, and you objected. You know, if I had a nickel for every time you've used that high school debate rule about Hitler, I'd be quite wealthy. Perhaps you're still debating at a high school level, but I moved beyond that a long time ago. I failed to see the relevance of what high school debate rules are on the question of Adolf Hitler. He's part of a principal part of the history of the 20th century. I think there's a clear analogy to what's going on in Europe at this time.
All right. clarify your comment about Hitler. As it was in relationship to debate points, but what was the point? Because you were making the point as we were going to a commercial break, and
the current situation is.
No, but you said something about debate. The person that brings up Hitler is basically doesn't have much to say.
Hitler, well, I believe in every case in modern times since World War II, it's a false analogy. Whether you're talking about Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
When Hillary Clinton said that 2 weeks ago, she was wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Hitler was, if I could just finish the point, geographically and historically, okay. We are, in many ways, where we were in 1914. One of the positive lessons of Munich and World War II is nations in Europe and North America and elsewhere are a lot less willing to tolerate overt aggression. We certainly weren't passive when Putin grabbed Crimea, one of Mr. Kuchelka's points. And beware of the Hitler analogy. I really mean that. It was no personal reference to John, whom I've listened to before.
Well, I just want to follow up on this particular point because the story briefly last week, and it appeared that it might have been a hoax, but the pamphlets that were being passed out suggesting that the Jews had to register brought up all kinds of, it brought denunciation on the part of the president, on the part of John Kerry, what a grotesque action it was. But again, the image that was going through my mind, and because Putin has referred to the thugs, as he has defined the thugs, he's used the term fascists, the fascists that have taken over. Then you've got Hillary Clinton using the Hitler reference.
She backed off. In fairness to Mrs. Clinton, she backed off on that, Bruce.
But she did. But the point is, then you have the pamphlets and registering Jews. I mean, there's a lot of things that are coming together here, and it seems to me that on the world stage of world opinion, someone is seeing some benefit in trying to point saying the other person is either a fascist or the other one is acting, you know, like Adolf Hitler. Do you see that? I mean, you're a culture guy. Do you see some of these things being, you know, spun into different scenarios for each side? I'm talking about between the United States and Putin himself.
Yeah, I see the veracity of your analysis, but I also want to piggyback on Art's point. Hitler was a singular event in human history of madness and evil. And I think that when people toss around metaphoric comparisons to him, it trivializes the full extent of his madness and evil, and it distracts us from understanding the behavior of foreign agents, even when they're despots, even when they're aggressive, even when they're acting in an unethical and illegal way.
John?
Well, you know, the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, possessed a vast nuclear arsenal, much of which still exists in the hands of Russia. Hitler never possessed the ability to strike the United States directly, thank God. Vladimir Putin has an arsenal of nuclear weapons and intercontinental missiles which could strike this country today. In fact, someone on Russian television boasted about this just a couple of weeks ago, boasted about the fact that Russia could reduce the United States to ashes with its nuclear arsenal. So there's a sense in which Russia today possesses power that Hitler could only dream of back in the 1930s and 1940s. I think the lesson of the 1930s is that you cannot allow an aggressive expansionist power to move on unimpeded, because there are only so many countries that you can throw to the wolves before the aggressor is at your doorstep. That's what they
learned. Mark Casella.
Speaking of aggressive expansive powers, NATO and the G7 powers, who are clawing at Ukraine economically. They want to cash in on the Ukraine. The people that are getting lost in this are the Ukrainian citizens, and half of those are ethnic Russians. And those people are struggling in their economy, and they want to be part of the EU, not because they love Europe, but because they want the economy and the freedom. Joining the EU would eventually bring those people, and that was part of the ousting, I think. So I think that's getting lost, and this vilifying Putin really prevents having any sort of real dialogue. Putin's backed into a corner, but we need Russia. Russia's been instrumental in our negotiations. They've been helping with Afghanistan and that war, the longest war in American history, speaking of interventionism. Secondly, they helped with Syria, which is a mess. I don't know how much help they had. They helped impose sanctions on Iran. And pushing them closer to China is certainly not going to help America's interests.
Well, there's also one thing, by the way, just to add to that litany, because in the New York Times today there was an opinion piece that referenced some of these points that you just made, Mark. And there was one thing that was added to it, which I was not aware of, and that is that Russia allows U.S. flights over Russia as it relates to equipment and troop deployment in Afghanistan. I was not aware of that. David.
Mark is getting to the point that I was preparing to make, that one of the relevant questions here is Vladimir Putin, despite his bully-like tactics that he's demonstrated recently, a rational actor? He's not a religious extremist, so he's not motivated by any kind of bizarre theology to bring mm-hmm. about the apocalypse in the world. Right. He's not showing a religious-like zeal in the loyalty to a political ideology like Nazism. So how much can we reason with him? And we better hope that the answer is to a large degree, because militarily, if we start bringing in military options, we start to discuss a really dangerous situation.
But when you're talking about military options, what about providing greater opportunity for the Ukrainian people to defend themselves? What about providing military effort to them?
So
is that good or bad in your view, John?
I think we should be doing that. I think it's one of the obvious pushbacks that we could be making. We helped persuade the Ukrainians to give up their nuclear arsenal. They had a portion of the old Soviet nuclear arsenal. If they had held on to it, none of this would be happening today, because Russia would not be trifling with a country that had nuclear weapons. We persuaded them to give them up. As far as Putin being vilified, Putin is a former colonel in the KGB. He briefly headed the surviving organization of the KGB, and his help in Syria consisted of providing Bashar Assad with the weaponry with which he is slaughtering his own people. I don't see how he's been helpful to America's vision of the world in Syria at all. And by the way, the Russians are not half the population of the Ukraine. They are nowhere near half the population of the Ukraine, a much smaller percentage.
Art, do you want to comment on that?
No.
Okay, Mark?
Back to the point about Russia's invasion, one more point I wanted to make. I dropped it.
Okay. I agree with what John is saying about the possibility of defending or at least assisting the Ukrainian urge for freedom and liberty and self-determination. Short of our own boots-on-the-ground involvement, I believe there is a role America can play in enhancing the opportunities for freedom around the world, especially when you're dealing with people who have a legitimate desire for freedom. One of the quandaries of Syria is that you are essentially forced to choose between HIV and cancer. Assad's gassing his own people to death, but the rebels are decapitating teenagers for refusing to swear allegiance to them. What do you do? Well, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. Neither did the United States. That's why we did almost nothing. But in the Ukrainian situation, you do have people who appear to be genuine small D Democrats.
I want to get back to you, Art. You talked about the comparison between World War II, the circumstances surrounding World War I, rather, and where we are today. What were the escalating points in, as it looks back to the 1914, what were the escalating points that led us to World War I that could be conceivably duplicated now?
I don't think they will be duplicated.
Right.
I think a general war could break out, but there was virulent nationalism throughout Europe, especially in Austria-Hungary and Germany, but by no means exclusively. There was a casual attitude toward war, because the Europeans, for a century after they got rid of Napoleon, it had very short, very decisive wars, usually won by Prussians and Germans. What remains consistent, I think, is the extraordinarily important diplomatic role of Germany. An expert on both Germany and Russia, George Kennan, wrote K-E-N-N-A-N. Any of his books is worth reading. The Decline of Bismarck's European Order, which came out in the 70s, is hard going, but I commend it because he describes parallels between the situation then and today that are really quite striking, including the importance of economics, which we haven't discussed this evening. But I urge us to pay some attention to at least.
David?
Kennan also was an anonymous an anonymous opponent to the Vietnam War, and that enhances his historical legitimacy and credibility.
John?
I don't believe that there's a great analogy to 1914. In 1914, you had six powers teamed up in groups of three, relatively evenly balanced. Italy was not as powerful as the other five, but you had five relatively equally balanced powers. They blundered and stumbled into war. There was no real ideological content whatsoever there. The governments, there was a certain rough similarity, certainly amongst the three Eastern empires. So I just don't see the analogy to 1914.
Okay, we'll let the audience weigh in on it, 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion, and Art Sear will have the floor. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Let's meet our guests around the round table, and we begin with Mark Casello. Mark.
Hi, I'm Mark Casello. I'm a professor of literature and communications at Calumet College of St. Joseph. I've also contributed to the Huffington Post. I've written in the past about the Occupy movement in Chicago, about the anti-NATO protests that took place here in Chicago in May 2012. We're coming up on the two-year anniversary of that. And there's
proud progressive.
Proud progressive.
Used to work for Walmart.
Used to work for Walmart and been liberated.
No, that's the real world.
John Kachelko.
John S. Kachelko. I served in the Illinois General Assembly and for many years as a trustee and town assessor in Cicero. Hold a master's degree in history from DePaul and did doctoral study at Loyola. Very proud of the fact that one of my liberal professors once said that I had one of the finest minds of the 13th century. And I consider that a great compliment from him.
Art Sear.
I'm Art
Sear. That sounds like something you would have said.
I'm Art Sear. I work at the Claussen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
David?
I'm David Masiotra. I'm a columnist with the Indianapolis Star, a regular contributor to the Daily Beast, the Federalist, and Splice Today, and I'm the author of a book which will come out about a year from now called All That We Learned About Living, the Art and Legacy of John Mellencamp. And on my first appearance on this program, I said something off the cuff, which has become my mantra. I believe in rock and roll more than I believe in any political platform.
Art, I want to go back to something, talking about what's happened in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union and now perhaps trying to put the gang back together again. Fareed Zakaria on his show today talked about, he had a guest who was making the point that when the wall fell, those that were left behind to pick up the pieces, no pun intended, tended to try to be a little more pro-Western than perhaps they should have. And that created a resentment within the Russian people, because when the economy didn't get really well and they didn't have the recovery that they thought they had had, and that we're now in a second opportunity, and some of the people that are pushing Putin and maybe Putin himself are really basically saying that, you know, that was a mistake to try to be too Western. We should do it a different way. We're going to be a world leader. We're not going to try to follow number one and sniff at their tails. We're going to do our own thing. And that was a mistake by some of the Russian leaders at the time, including Gorbachev and Yeltsin. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think so. I think it's very thought-provoking. I'd like to think about it some more, but...
Well, you've got 10 seconds.
Right, well, this is radio and TV, absolutely. There's a strong historical nationalism in Russia and the other republics, more or less, and a lack of democratic, with a small d, tradition, and a great willingness to embrace autocratic leaders. We all know that Putin's become very popular. Stalin is still very popular, and not just with the really old folks still walking around. All that makes Russia very different from us. Kennan wrote in 54, they are not like us. Americans tend to think everybody wants to be a good guy, which is the way we see ourselves, or at least they should, and we'll help them get there. Russians are very different, and we should not fool ourselves about that. The main point about World War
I... Do you think some of our leaders have been fooled?
I don't know. I wish President Bush had not said he looked into Putin's eyes and he really liked what he saw.
He saw a crucifix.
If I could just finish the point for a change. World War I was the war that no one expected. I'm very glad I provoked so much discussion here. World War I was the war that no one expected, and I think we should return to that, too.
I wish that Hillary Clinton had not given that silly toy button to Foreign Minister Lavrov at the beginning of the Obama administration, laughing into the camera about how we were going to reset our policy with the Russian Federation. I can't imagine Dean Rusk or Henry Kissinger participating in an absurd vignette like that. I think that set the tone for the Obama's administration dealing with Russia, which I think has been very ineffective.
But what about previous presidents, though? Has anybody taken – I mean, do you take exception with George Bush's comment about looking into Putin's
eyes? Oh, yes. One of the differences between conservatives and the left is that we're willing to criticize Republican presidents when they make a mistake. I was very unimpressed with much of the Bush foreign policy and said so. Democrats tend to be just sort of slavishly devoted to Barack Obama and defend whatever he does or whatever he says. Even the way he's performed during this whole situation in the Ukraine. So I thought Yeltsin was a good man. I thought Yeltsin was a good and decent man. And he had personal failings which made him ineffective ultimately as a president. But I think that he had a spark of decency there. Putin is a man who has said that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century.
Well, he's playing to a domestic audience.
You know, it's shocking. You know, there are still statues of Lenin all over the place. You see him in the eastern Ukraine in that hailing a cab format. You still see the red flag with the hammer and sickle. I know this is perhaps will bother you, Art, but if there were statues of Hitler anywhere, if people were waving the swastika flag anywhere in Germany, that would be big, ominous news, and it would be a very bad thing. But somehow we just ignore the fact that there are all these survivals of the old Soviet Union visible still in that part of the world.
David.
I'd like to issue a reminder. I said with my tongue a little bit in cheek, I believe in rock and roll more than politics. But the Russians and Americans do have some similarities. Joseph Stalin and the communist regime outlawed rock and roll and jazz records and blue jeans. And there was such a demand from the people for what we think of as American entertainment that then permeated into a political sentiment for freedom and liberty and personal choice that I think we can draw some essential similarities, the human desire and drive for liberty and rebellion and creativity. I don't think that's purely or merely an American art. I think it's perhaps an art that we've mastered, but that inspires people all around the world.
And Putin's crackdown on gays and lesbians is something that is supported by a lot of Americans, including a Franklin Graham.
Yeah, there's
television day saying that he agreed with Putin.
There's a great punk rock band with a name that I can't pronounce on the radio, Something Riot, that people can look it up at home, who've ignited people and have garnered a great deal of excitement and support.
Mark?
I think the panelists are sort of voicing something that I think is sort of the problem, which is Americans' foreign policy hubris, which is we feel like every other nation has to somehow either positively respond to our cultural output that we, you know, smatter across the globe, or militarily our influence through the G8 and the G7 and NATO's influence should permeate, and other countries must respond economically to our will. But there's parts of the world, the strong, strong Russian nationalism, you know, they don't care in some countries what the United States does. I think we need to deal with a new reality in the globe, which is that Chinese culture, Russian culture, what's happening in Latin America and the Latin American economy, Africa, those are distinct cultural areas, and they have distinct beliefs, and they're trying to structure societies in a way that work best for their people. And the U.S. is always sticking our foot into these other people's countries and their governments, and it hurts to the detriment of our citizens who are here without mental health care. We're spending billions on these ramped-up NATO operations now, you know, getting troops in Poland. We're going to put weapons in Poland to protect them from the impending so-called Russian invasion of Poland, you know, repeating these World War II analogies. And I think that's the big problem. I think getting back to the earlier point about the average American on the street, they see that capitalism isn't quite working perfectly here. So why are we so eager to just dump our problems on everybody else under the name of our own ferocious nationalism?
Art, sir.
I've always liked the Indianapolis Star in Indiana, but my respect and affection is going up significantly here tonight. During the height of the Cold War, Dwight Eisenhower and even John Foster Dulles, I don't think Elvis went to the Soviet Union. However, they promoted cultural exchanges, which included jazz,
mm-hmm.
the greatest American jazz and jazz players.
Yeah, along Duke Ellington.
Exactly. Yeah, and Louis Armstrong, along with Leonard Bernstein and the Bolshoi Ballet, and also scientific exchanges are not only our way of life, but our popular culture, for better and worse, is extremely appealing.
But let me add to that. But America also,
Mark,
the wonderful Gabriel Garcia Marquez died this week, and America prevented him from getting a visa and entering the country until 1995 under Bill Clinton. Richard Wright, the famous Chicago social realist novelist, author of Native Son, died in Ghana. He wasn't allowed back in the United States. So, you know, as much as we laud our cultural output, we're not so open to other people's cultures. And
Hurricane Jackson also passed away.
General Vernon Walters, who was a great military man and diplomat, once said that for the first half of the 20th century, the European powers determined the fate of the world, and they catered two disastrous world wars. In the second half of the 20th century, the inexperienced, uncouth Americans organized international affairs, and we maintained the peace during that half century, avoided another global war, and ultimately brought down the evil empire of the Soviet Union. I don't think America has anything to apologize for. NATO was organized as a defensive alliance in response to the expansionism of Stalin's Soviet Union. And it was very successful, and I don't think that NATO threatens anybody except maybe the expansionist ambitions of Vladimir Putin.
Do you think he really does? Do you think he's afraid of NATO?
Well, I think if NATO were if it were well led, if we had strong leadership, the potential is there.
A lot of ifs.
But right now, no. Under a weak American administration, he's going to push as much as he can. He realizes he has about 2 years. He doesn't know who the next president is going to be.
What do you think the next step is? That's the question. That's the question. I'm going to ask that question of everybody. What is the next step? Is there another shoe to fall? And if so, where is it going to fall? And is there anything that we as a country can do to prevent it from falling? That's the question. We'll be back with our answers. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8289. I'm back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. This past week on Wednesday, Bob Saget, comedian, was here. We did an evening with Bob Saget. Ro Khan from WLS Radio was the moderator. It was a great session. A lot of good questions. A lot of introspective responses from Bob Saget. I really had a great admiration for him. I liked him as a comedian before Wednesday night, and after Wednesday night, before, during, and after the session, I got to like him as a human being. If you're interested in seeing what that evening was like, you can go to our website, museum.tv. The full presentation will be on museum.tv. It's currently running right now. And again, Ro Khan, we thank you very much for doing a great job of hosting that evening. Let's go to Carl listening to us on KMJ, one of America's great radio stations from San Jose, California. And next week, we will be back in California for a couple of weeks of broadcast, but nice to hear from San Jose tonight. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a good discussion, and I've been amazed that somebody who's gone 15 times to Ukraine and the Soviet Union, and I was there when Putin was first elected. I've watched him. All that somebody has to do is have read the articles that have come out in the news periodically since that time to see that you're talking about a guy, Putin, who has systematically eliminated all opposition, taken over the national television networks, all three of them, jailed his opponents like Khodorkovsky for 10 years. The most prominent journalists have been killed who wrote a book about Anna Politkovskaya, who wrote a book about Putin. Remember the guy that was writing about that stuff, Litvinenko, who was murdered in London. All somebody has to do is have read this stuff to see what Putin is. Now, this guy is looking 200 years in advance. He's looking back to Peter the Great. He doesn't care if in the next 10 years this or that happens. He's looking 100 years in advance, and if he can take all of Ukraine, he will do it. The only thing
okay,
that
Carl,
might moderate...
Carl, let me ask, you made a very strong point. Let me ask you the question that I posed of everyone before we went to the break. What do you think is the next shoe? What is his next step? You've made the
case that he's got
a master plan in place. What's the next step?
Right now, he can take territory without even firing a shot. I think three or four guys have been killed in the last couple of weeks. One guy was shot in Ukrainian man. If he can just keep taking property like that, no problem. But if nobody stands up to a bully, and he thinks he can get away with it, he's going to take it. The only way to deal with him is to let him know, and he knows that we are stronger than him. But do we have the will to stand up to him? Let me just say there's only one thing that can moderate him, and that is if somehow he's going to lose his fortune, which he's amassed of $40 or $50 billion that he has taken from the corruption. And let me just say one more thing, because I've studied this, and people don't really understand why there is so much mafia and criminality, organized crime, because during the communist years, that was the only way to do business. If you're a businessman, it was against the law. And so they have this whole culture that has developed about organized crime for 70 years. And it just continued.
John, could you, I want to get everybody's response to that. John,
I think,
and then also, where do you think the next shoe falls?
I think the game plan is that you persuade the government of Kiev to concede autonomy to the eastern Ukraine. Once they get a legislature and a coat of arms and a flag and all the trappings, they declare their independence. Russia immediately recognizes their independence. And then they either, after a decent interval, apply for membership in the Russian Federation, or they simply become a client state of the Russian Federation. Be the
Art
same
Sir,
thing.
What do you think happens next? Next shoe to fall?
I don't know. I certainly think
we
what's
know,
been
but
described
knows, but we're
is,
guessing.
Is plausible. I don't know. I really don't know. And I think we should be prepared for any eventuality. But I think both the caller and John make some very good points.
David.
Yeah, it's difficult to make any prediction or speculation at this point. However, preparing for the worst is always a wise course of action.
What does that mean? What do you mean preparing for the worst?
Aggression from Vladimir Putin. The problem then becomes, though, what is the appropriate response? You don't want to throw meat on a fire.
Well, we have elections coming up. What do you think the next shoe to fall is, Mark? Then I want to go to the elections.
A standoff a la the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, they've got nuclear weapons. I don't think we want to get into a ground war in Russia.
No. So. Do you think that would be the next step?
I don't think it's the next step, but there's going to be a stalemate. You're going to see the push to put weapons into Poland like we were trying to do.
Last week, we had a guest who said that one of the great concerns was... Granted, what signals are we sending to the Europeans, but what signal are we sending to our other allies around the world? What's happening in Korea? I mean, what's happening in the other regions of the world where they are looking to the United States to stand up firmly against an aggressor? Are they reading this as you perceived weakness by the United States, and are they going to start some action someplace else when we're sort of bogged down in our focus on Europe?
I think that's very plausible. There's a great deal of hostility on the part of North Korea. We have to be concerned about Iran and its march toward a nuclear weapon. I think the rule of history is that weakness on the part of the forces of freedom, the forces of order in the world, breeds aggression from the forces of disorder and of evil in the world. And that was the lesson of the 1930s, and I think it still applies today. Ronald Reagan used to say, America never got into a war because it was too strong. Projecting a forceful position does not breed war. It breeds order.
Say again, Art.
Vietnam.
How does Vietnam apply to what I just
enormous
said?
Enormous military power. We certainly were wrong about the outcome of that war.
That was our choice. We chose not to win. We could have won the war in Vietnam in an afternoon if we wanted to use
that.
We had awesome power. We never used it.
We destroyed the country, killed a million civilians.
Maybe we should have killed 5 million. John hasn't told us anything
That's
about what we should
enough.
Do specifically in military terms in Europe.
Paying the consequences.
I don't know that
until
America
everyone
killed
drives
a million
the tank
civilians in the Vietnam War. I don't know where you get that statistic, but that's one that I've never seen.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, we are going to say farewell for those listening to this program on television, watching it on television. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to continue for another whole hour if these people don't kill each other during the commercial break here. We have some people that don't get along with each other tonight. We will continue that discussion as we seek peace here at the table on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Mark Casello, Art Sear, John Kochelko, and David Masiulcha. Our program tonight coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. If you want to go to the website, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet me a question, it's at btbdumont. Tonight, with our guests around the table, we're going to sort of switch gears in the second hour of our radio broadcast, and for those watching us on television, this will be new to you. But I want to begin with a comment that I made maybe 6 or 7 months ago on this particular program. Someone was making a very strong statement about the greatness of America, and I think most people would agree that America is a great nation. But when we say that we are the greatest nation, are we saying that just out of a sense of pride in the country? Are we saying it out of a level of intellectual awareness? Are we saying it in a comparison way with other successful nations around the world, whatever that means? And I'll let everybody sort of define that. But are we the greatest nation on earth? And I'm going to begin with Mark Casello.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Certainly, America, the diversity of America, has created something history's really never seen. So in that regard, the fact that so many people live together from such diverse backgrounds, are able to coexist, we have this hugely productive economy, all of those things are great. My lamentation, and I'll just keep it brief, is that sometimes I feel that our claims to greatness and our interest in being great sometimes helps us overlook those amongst us who need help, and often prevents us from fixing systems in our country that could use some.
David Masiulcha, your response.
Historically, America has an important role in the world. It's as far as my knowledge goes, the only country founded on an idea, and an inspirational one at that. It wasn't a land grab. It wasn't broken up by a foreign entity. However, the sins and flaws and failures of this country are also as great as its achievements, and sometimes it strikes as much pride as I have in America's achievements, in America's diversity, in America's inspirational power of liberty. Sometimes it strikes me as insecure to keep proclaiming America as the greatest nation on earth. In my own life, people who are that great don't tend to go around saying it constantly. That may be a compensatory device.
Do you think the government says that? I mean, clearly there are those from all particular parties. There are those that serve in the military that say these things. But is it? It's not an official edict of government. Has it ever been, in your view?
It's not an official edict, but it's certainly provided some bedrock for policy, and it's a big part of our rhetoric. Ronald Reagan called America the city on a hill, putting it in messianic terminology. George W. Bush talked about American exceptionalism. Even President Obama, when he rose to national stardom at the 2004 convention, said, only in America could someone like me rise to these heights. And only in America is overstating the case. There's not a lot of places in the world where it can happen, but there are other ones.
Art Sear, your comment on this.
Yes, I think we're the greatest nation in the world, and it reflects our patriotism. Responding to the dual observation you made, it reflects our patriotism, which is important and positive. And it also reflects the fact that we are enormously successful in terms of the rule of law. We do owe something to our British friends in that regard. The Industrial Revolution, we owe something to the British as well in that regard, but given the vast space and resources of this country.
Is there
been remarkably effective.
Is there an aura of arrogance?
Yeah. Yes, but I do think that we're more realistic than we were, say, a half century ago. I wish our leaders would talk more about patriotism, personally.
John Kuchelko.
I believe we're not only the greatest nation in the world, we're the greatest nation in the history of the world. I don't think there's ever been a nation that exercised the kind of preponderance economically and militarily that the United States does. In 1945, we could have ruled the world if we had wanted to. We were the sole possessor of the atomic bomb. Our military forces dwarfed those of the rest of the world put together. Instead, we demobilized our army, put our fleet into mothballs, and came home and would have been quite happy to have let the rest of the world continue on.
Is that a mistake?
Well, we quickly learned that it was because of the expansionism of Stalin, and we had to quickly reverse course under Harry Truman and once again ramp up our military. But the interesting thing is Charles Dickens wrote when he came to America in the 1840s that Americans were telling him that we were the greatest nation in the world when we didn't have the economic or military power. So I think it is based on more than just our raw wealth and power. It's our Constitution, and I wholeheartedly agree with Art. I mean, it's nice to find something we agree on. I think we owe a debt of to our British ancestry. We are in many ways a continuation of the greatness of Britain. Our predecessor is a great power. Our Constitution draws from the British experience. And so it's our balance of government, the fact that we draw the immigrants from all over the world. We have this diversity of talents and abilities, so many things. And our natural wealth, of course, the blessings God gave to this land.
Well, that sounds like a 4th of July speech. Mark,
sure.
Where is John wrong in your view? Or do you think
he's
wrong?
Well, we're also the greatest nation in the world at incarcerating our citizens. 10% of our population is incarcerated, many for nonviolent offenses, some for minor drug offenses. And I think that's a way to sort of conceal some of the problems in our system.
But in other countries, you commit crimes and you're either caned to death or you're put to death.
Well, and certainly...
By the way, you have a very low bar for being caned to death. The over-incarceration of those in America, as you know, is a pet topic of mine. But I think there are far more worse countries in the world when it comes to treating their criminals.
Certain, but it's sort of the unintended consequence of having a legal system that works so well. Charles Dickens was also very aware of the entanglements of, you know, legal systems and how they can tie a person up and ruin their lives. I mean, we're also the nation where we're disturbed citizens, you know, commit acts of terror against their own government because they feel so entrapped and desperate. The other unintended consequence of the mass incarceration is the disenfranchisement of African-American voters throughout the country. These African-Americans and people of low income who've been unjustly arrested, convicted with felonies because our law declares certain things are felonies.
David?
One of the things that makes this country great is in danger of evaporating before our eyes, because when I spoke about the inspirational power of the idea that founded America, it was the idea that if you were a Mason, your child doesn't have to be a Mason, that you can shape your own destiny. Of course, that promise wasn't open to everyone in the beginning, but we're no longer teaching what made that promise possible, and that endangers America's status as a great nation.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8289, and this is an opportunity for your participation. If we were to start the country all over again, what changes would we make? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Before the break, I asked a provocative question. If the forefathers were to get together again And we invited our guests this evening to sit in on that discussion and that debate. What changes when you think of the Constitution and you think of our way of life? Is there something else that we should have done differently, or is there something we should have changed right from the get-go, John, that would make life even more successful, more enjoyable in the United States?
Well, of course, it's daunting to question the wisdom of Madison and Hamilton and Franklin and Washington, as well as some of the lesser-known lights. But the two things that I would change, the Constitution never specifically gave to the Supreme Court the power to nullify a federal law or a state constitution. It's a power that was assumed by the Supreme Court. I believe there should be an amendment to the Constitution that would give, say, a two-thirds majority of both houses of Congress, with the concurrence of the president, the ability to overturn a decision of the Supreme Court touching on the constitutionality of a federal law. I don't believe our great issues should be decided by five unelected individuals who nowadays have not only do not derive their powers from the electorate, but never have faced the electorate. We don't put people on the court.
All right, so that's one change. Now let's sure. Get everybody. Art, what change would you make?
Are you doing this in 1776 2014?
No.
It has a bearing.
Whatever. I mean,
we're transported back.
We're transported back in time. Mm. Is there anything in that Constitution that you say, you know, the more I think of it, you know what? You know, maybe we should, you know, freedom of speech is a good idea, but maybe we should put some limits on it. Anything like that?
We're the only country that has a First Amendment that means mm-hmm. anything. The Europeans do not.
Right.
I'm all for the First Amendment, and the bill, and everybody who appears on a program like this should be, and our Constitution.
Should we have let women vote from the get-go?
Sure, and we should have abolished slavery, but you've got to be a realist, and I am so profoundly conservative, I'm really put off by that. It's the kind of thing that academics do. I don't hear radio and TV personalities do that so much because it's so utopian.
Well, because we have 2 hours, and this is, we have intellects around here to talk about the issues of war and peace.
One issue that's important to remember when discussing the founding of the United States is the miserable and horrendous mistreatment of the indigenous people here, the natives. I understand that we can't go back and change history, but that your question assumes that we can. I have had a wonderful opportunity to have several conversations with a guy named Ricky Medlock, who's a guitar player with the band Lynyrd Skynyrd. And Medlock is putting together a show called Homeland Nation, in which it's brilliant reality TV to compete with all of the frivolity and stupidity of reality TV, in which he goes country across the country, tribe to tribe, emphasizing and spotlighting Native culture as it exists now in contemporary terms, not just historically. So I think our violation of the treaties that we made with the Native people are, in some cases, atrocious mass murders of those people.
You would have handled that in a different, obviously different.
Certainly in a way that honored the human rights and autonomy of those people. It's very difficult to discuss with a rearview mirror, but it's something that bears mentioning.
The question, then we're going to get Mark's comment as well, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
We've got callers that do want to weigh in on this.
Yeah, I would say that the creation of corporations and the laws that govern corporations and that have turned them into people, that the corporations are treated as people under the law, and the way corporate profit structures are distributed to shareholders, and there's very little accountability towards wages and treatment of the workers.
But you're more obsessed, and I'll use that term.
Okay,
you're more obsessed with our economic system than you are with the Constitution, aren't you?
Well, the economic system reflects the Constitution.
Well, I know,
I would disagree very strongly with Mark.
Well, I would have asked the framers for a little more clarity in the Constitution when it came, because the Constitution isn't explicitly capitalist, and I think there's room, and we're certainly not a fully, you know, fully capitalist system. There's socialistic elements to our society, and I don't think that's necessarily a dirty word.
But I don't know how it's possible to preserve political and social liberty without having economic liberty. So what changes would you make? How far would you go in encroaching upon the free market?
Sure. I mean, currently right now, somebody working two minimum wage jobs doesn't have economic liberty. I think FDR's second Bill of Rights addressed that. He said, if you, you know, or the people who've been foreclosed on, you know, during this mortgage crisis where the banks got better treatment than the homeowner. I think those are some of the changes that I would make. I would say, okay, well, a mortgage company, if the value of your property is dropped precipitously due to poor economic choices by a system that we've created and engineered to allow corruption, which are a lot of presumptions on my part, I think that the average citizen should have a greater right to recourse in our legal system. And I think the corporate model should be include more profit-sharing basis for the workers.
I think we may have another area where John and Art agree. John first.
Our economy exploded in the 19th century precisely because of the free market aspects that were being pursued. And millions and tens of millions of immigrants came to our shores to participate in that prosperity.
Let me finish.
Our economic system has provided greater wealth for a greater share of the people than any economic system ever devised. It's superior to any form of economy that was ever practiced or ever has been practiced in the
world. Art's here.
You started out with the founders and the Constitution, and we certainly could have used more Jeffersons and Hamiltons and Washingtons and absolutely Lincolns. But it's important what they didn't do is micromanage the future. They purposely stayed away from an extremely detailed document. Most of the developing countries in the world have endless constitutions, which they're constantly ignoring and overthrowing. So the wisdom of the founders is they made room for the kind of debate we're having tonight.
We are going to move forward, and I'm looking at my call board now. We come from a broadcast museum, and we have three mics on the phone. We got five mics around the table. We have three mics. Let's go to Mike in Chicago. You're on the air listening to us on WLS. Mic number one, go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Mike.
I'd be interested to see what you guys think about the Northwestern Princeton, that studied the state of American politics and determined that we're not a democracy anymore, we're an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the study between Princeton and Northwestern by Gillen and Page, I believe. And I think it proves what a lot of Americans felt during the Occupy movement when many people came out in the streets a couple years ago, that in the study, they basically tried to control for many factors, and they said that essentially people with money influence public policy more than citizens who are, you know, organized at a grassroots level.
Where's the movement now?
So the movement.
You don't hear much about them anymore.
Sure.
Are they still out there?
The movement's out there, yeah. I recently had a panel and brought together some people who had participated. They've moved into sort of more traditional forms of organizing, community organizing. They're working for the labor unions. Some are grassroots organizing in the community still here in Chicago. Mm. Others are also working in like cooperative gardens and directly in the community.
Mike in Austin, Texas, you're next listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead. Mike, are you there?
Come on, Mike.
Click.
Well, I guess maybe one of our mics doesn't work. Let's go to Mike in Spokane, Washington on KXLY. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Happy Easter to you.
Happy Easter to you.
God bless. You know, this is a great country, a compassionate country. But today, religious freedom, I think, is endangered, as it was in the American colonies when Catholics had little freedom. We know Roger Williams helped the Catholics in Rhode Island. But today it is Obamacare forcing Catholic colleges and schools to use abortion artifacts, which is contrary to church teaching. So maybe we should look at the Supreme Court, have term limits or less federal judicial power.
Term limits on the Supreme Court. John, you like that idea?
No, I don't believe in that. I would deal with the court as I indicated. I think the Catholic Church faces rough going in the United States in the years ahead, unless present trends are changed. I can foresee very great difficulty for the Church of it being accused by the left of being filled with hate because of its teachings on abortion and on homosexuality. And I find it's not inconceivable to me that not too distant future, we're going to see demands that the tax exemption of the Catholic Church be withdrawn because of its preaching of hate. That term is used routinely by the left for anyone who dares to disagree with it. And I see the church in the crosshairs.
Has the power of secular America overtaken the power of religious America?
Well, I think religion is still the majority is still on of Americans is still on the side of those who are devout and believers. But unfortunately, the seculars control the media, they control Hollywood, they control the academic world, they control those who speak and write and talk and control the debate. So that gives them a power that they could not win by numbers, but they do win because of their preponderance in the media.
Do they have too much power, Mark? The media. We're talking about media. Media and secular society, have they replaced religion as the molder of our fabric of life?
I think the population's shifting dramatically and is going to continue shifting in our ethnic makeup, and I think our belief structures as a culture are changing and shifting. I think spirituality is always going to play a role in the United States, but I think in the younger generations, spirituality doesn't necessarily mean doctrinal religious practice.
David.
The reason that the Catholic Church and other religious organizations are losing ground on issues such as gay rights and gay marriage is not because of the power of the media, which is vast. It's because they have the correct argument. It must be convenient to base everything you believe on an important psychological, sexual, and sociological issue on a single text written thousands of years ago, but in the interim period between then and now, we've had numerous studies and developments of knowledge that show otherwise for anyone using rationality and drawing conclusions based on evidence.
Art, John, do you want to comment? Everybody does, but we do have to break. 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers on the line. Also, again, what would you change? If you could go back with the founding fathers and be able to whisper in their ears, what would you change about the Constitution and life in America? Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our guests around the table, Mark Casello is here. Mark Casello is an associate professor of English at Calumet College of St. Joseph. He is also a contributor to the Huffington Post, and he proudly wears the banner of liberal progressive. And you want to go any further than that?
I think
liberal progressive says it all.
That's good.
John Kochelko also joins us. He is a historian. He's a lecturer, former elected official in Cicero, Illinois, and also served in the Illinois General Assembly. Art Sear joins us. He is the director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, since 1998. Also a columnist and also graduate of UCLA and Harvard, and went to Hollywood High School. And also author of the book, After the Cold War, American Foreign Policy, Europe and Asia. And also David Masiolcha joins us. He is the author and cultural critic. He is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, contributor to the Daily Beast, and author of the soon-to-be-published book next year called All That We Learned About Living, the Art and Legacy of John Mellencamp. Let's go to calls. Back to Brian in Roselle, Illinois, listening to one of our flagship station, WLS, the radio home of Roe and Roper. Go ahead.
Good evening, guys. Enjoy the show. It's great as always.
Thank you.
You know, my observation is you always hear Americans yelling about their rights. Well, along with the Bill of Rights, I think we need a Bill of Responsibilities that we need to hold the American people to qualify as a citizen. For example, it's shocking how many Americans do not even know how their government works. I mean, it should be rudimentary that you know who your congressman is. You know who your governor is. And I can think of some others. I mean, you should be able to know.
By the way, if you are a new citizen, that's one of the questions, the entrance exam. The entrance exam for the people who are immigrants who come here. The entrance exam to be an American asks just those basic questions.
In
but
English.
A school system, but school systems around the United States, controlled by politicians, in many cases elected school boards, 15 years ago, they took civics out of the curriculum so that people don't need to know basic things like that.
Mm-hmm. Just a few other quick points, if I might. Another thing is national service. I think most 18-year-olds are clueless. I mean, there's a small percentage of kids that are extremely sharp at 18, 19, but the vast majority are not. They don't know what they want to do. And I think they should either do 2 years in the military of some type or some type of national service. I mean, whether it's helping the elderly or cleaning parks, whatever it would be. But I think every 18, 19-year-old should do something like that to help form a national identity. I think our military should move to more of the Israeli model. I think we should have a huge, huge reserve force, not a professional standing army. And that way we all have skin in the game. We would all learn something. And then that way when some ill-advised president decides to go in some stupid war, the American people would rise up and pay attention and not allow that to happen.
That's a good idea.
Responsibility.
I'll get everybody's response to it, then I'll give you one more.
Absolutely.
Good ideas?
Absolutely.
Good ideas of this caller?
FDR wanted universal military service at the end of World War II, but the idea never went anywhere. I'm not sure that it is a good idea.
So, why?
Because I think I'm concerned when you expand it beyond the military service is one thing, but when it becomes civilian service, then it becomes, I think, liberal make work, putting you into government approved projects that are morally and socially uplifting in the eyes of the government. And I'm concerned about that. Defending your country is one thing, but this other possibility is something else.
So, Mark, what do you think?
Horrific.
Getting back to his idea about the absence of teaching of civics and things, I don't think that's a mistake. I think it's intentional. The less the citizens know about the economy, the way it functions, the less they know about civics.
Keep them stupid.
Keep them stupid, keep them controlled.
You don't think that, David, you think it's a bad idea?
Horrific idea. Terrible.
Tell Brian why
it's not a terrific idea.
Well, no, horrific.
Horrific.
Well, first of
it
all.
It was horrific, Brian, not terrific. Well, we have one terrific and one horrific.
Well,
go ahead.
First of all, the draft did not prevent wars in Korea or Vietnam. So I'm not sure about. George W. Bush wanted to invade Iraq. He would have done so if there was a draft. Nothing was stopping him. I don't want to empower the government to be able to tell me or any 18, 19-year-old, I was that about 10 years ago, what they should do with their lives for the next 2 years. I enjoy living in a free society. I don't want the government telling me to put on a uniform and go kill people for a cause I may not share. And as my distinguished colleague here said, I don't want the government telling me to participate in some project that they sanction as morally worthy. I can make those decisions for myself.
John.
Just a quick comment. I think we live in a state where, unfortunately, most of the time you'd rest more easily if you didn't know who the governor was.
All right. We move on. Brian, thanks very much. Boom, boom.
Stand up tonight.
Paul, Art, did you have a comment? Final comment?
Yeah,
here?
Since I seem to be in a minority, the.
How do you like it?
It's not new. Nothing new. Jimmy Carter, his Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, they believe in national service and promote it. Decent public servants do. It's going nowhere since the end of the draft. In response to the caller and his praise of the Israelis, late in the Vietnam War, Congress passed a law that if we go to war, we have to mobilize the reserves and National Guard. That's a way of not limiting and prejudicing those who serve, mm-hmm. not discriminating against, especially the men who carry rifles. We have an increasingly segregated military and increasingly corporate military moved from the rest of society. We're not going to get a draft, but we should get something. Ideas of national service, the Peace Corps, sophisticated people sneered. The Kennedy brothers stole it from Hubert Humphrey, who got it from Eleanor Roosevelt, and another Mrs. Roosevelt fuzzy idea. It's been enormously popular and successful. Other domestic service agencies and non-military nonprofits are growing. So I very much support a president who is willing to take a risk and address these things seriously, which we have not addressed for many years. It's very dangerous. Eisenhower, the military-industrial the most important thing I can look at Ike, it's on YouTube, his farewell address, his warning about the military-industrial complex. It's all there, folks, more profoundly than any of us here.
Even more reason
speech,
not to.
His greatest speech.
One of them. I think his inaugurals are pretty good.
I would just say the Peace Corps has been successful because it's voluntary. I have no problem with the Peace Corps as a voluntary agency.
Okay.
I don't want people drafted into the Peace Corps.
No.
Okay.
Well,
exactly.
We're not going to do that.
Exactly. Brian, thanks very much for your recommendations. Let's go to Paul, listening to us near Joliet, also listening to us on WLS. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question was, what are you guys' thoughts on term limits for members of both houses of Congress? Specifically, my idea would be 6 years for the House and 12 years for the Senate. I'm just kind of sick and tired of seeing these career politicians in Washington not listening to the people of their constituency.
Term limits. Let's start with you, Mark.
Sure. I think in theory, term limits would be good. You've got half the time, a person's elected to Congress, they're spending time fundraising, making phone calls, and they're distracted from the duty of governing.
John Cajalgo.
I'm totally opposed to term limits. I think the voters should have the right to elect whomever they want as often as they want. I would repeal...
And give them as much money as they want.
Absolutely. That comes with freedom. That comes with our form of government. And I would repeal the two-term limitation on the president. I think it's a terrible idea. I think the country would have been in terrible shape in 1940 if FDR had not been able to seek a third term. I think his leadership in World War II was superb, and we would have been deprived of that if there had been a two-term limitation in the 1930s.
And you wanted a third term for Reagan, too, didn't you?
And I think, but in his case, I think his, we now know his age was at a point where I don't know that he would have sought a third term because he was 70 when he arrived in the White House. So I think it's unlikely he would have
Bill
sought
Clinton
a third
would have, though.
Perhaps, and if the voters had wanted to reelect him, I would not have been among his voters, but that's the public would have had the right to do so.
We have term limits. It's called us, you and me, citizens, voters. If we don't care for a politician, we can throw her or him out. I do think the point made earlier about the Supreme Court and politics is important. We used to have lots of politicians on the Supreme Court. We now appoint ideologues, activists, academics, mm-hmm. and the court doesn't function well.
Yeah.
It's dysfunction. Earl Warren, the Brown decision would have been 5-4, but he spent mm-hmm. almost a year meeting with his colleagues, and it was 9-0. That's a politician who knows what he's doing in action.
Yeah, Art's point is excellent. An idea like term limits is a Band-Aid for the gunshot wound that results from American apathy. If Americans were more involved in national politics, local politics, public affairs, more aware, more conscientious, they would exercise the term limit of the vote, and we wouldn't have to worry about these cranky officials collecting dust in the Senate chamber who seem to grow more useless with every day.
Do you think, and you deal with students on a daily basis, Mark, are the students of today, are they apathetic? Are they more apathetic than when you were,
sure,
2 years old?
You know, it's complex because depending on what social status the student is coming from, economic background, students coming from a more affluent economic background have what I call a certain entitlement to power. They come in assuming that they're going to run a corporation, assuming that they're going to wield power in society, whereas the students I teach who come from lower-income families tend to come in thinking, like, my voice doesn't matter or my voice should be expressed culturally within my own community with my friends, but civic service encounters with, you know, traditional forms of government are sort of non-existent in many minds of young people.
Does that go back to, because of that feeling, does it go back to basic things that they're taught even in high school? As we said, they haven't had civics for 20 years. You know, most people don't get out of high school. They don't know the first thing about our economic system. They don't know how to balance checkbooks. I mean, really practical stuff.
I was amazed.
They're not taught in grammar school, middle school, or high schools.
I was amazed. My father was a high school student. I was amazed by how much he knew about government and history and how much he had learned in a little high school in Kansas where he went to school compared to what college graduates today, how little they know about the important things in life. So I think our educational system is failing, doing an abysmal job.
David, you've got some comments you want to make on Common Core. We will do that when we come back. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border since 1980. This is Bruce Dumont from Chicago. I'm back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. So we've got about 15 minutes left on the broadcast this evening. And David, you wanted to make a comment about an issue. You reside in Indiana, as does, and actually you don't. You teach in Indiana, but you traveled to Indiana. You wanted to make a comment about sort of a growing controversy in that state, which also is happening and brewing in other regions all over the United States. And it's about Common Core, the basic things that are taught in high school. And you have some, give us a little summary of what's happening in Indiana and why you are concerned about it.
Yeah, I live in Indiana, and I write for our largest newspaper, the Indianapolis Star. And Common Core has become a big debate and discussion all over the country, but especially in Indiana. It's a set of seemingly innocuous, but I believe dangerous educational standards coming from really federal direction issued to the states. Mike Pence, our governor, decided to opt out of Common Core, which was a terrific move to make. And I recently wrote a column about Common Core and have been in correspondence with Andrea Neal, who's on the Indiana State Board of Education, who's leading the fight there against it. And there's two big problems with Common Core that I have. First is within my discipline. One of my many gigs as a freelancer is I teach some college English courses. Common Core sought to replace 50% of literary text with informational text. Story, the power of story, is really what makes our lives meaningful. So to downplay and diminish the role of story in the education of a child is a terrible disservice. But also, more generally and philosophically, I object to the idea of concentrated power, centralized power, standardizing what a decent education means for everybody throughout the country.
But aren't there some basic things, fact-based things, such as, you know, how Congress works? Aren't there some basic fact-based things that really should be known by a student?
Yes.
In 48 states, and that teachers could probably agree on a significant portion of those?
Yes, certainly, and those still existed, but to go back to my earlier point, Indiana determined on its own that they wanted 100% literary text before Common Core came into play. So why should a federal entity limit that? Why should a federal entity tell a rural school in Kentucky that it has to have the same curriculum as an inner city school in Chicago? Yeah, we need certain guidelines and limitations and instruction, but let's have more freedom that represents the diversity of our students, the diversity of their needs and interests.
Sure. This issue is close to my heart. I teach college as well, English and communications. And the problem with Common Core, first of all, Mike Pence sees it as a political wedge issue that
The
governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, because social issues are working less powerfully as a wedge. So it allows to make this top-down argument that the Common Core is government oppression of children and your choice as a parent through the imposition of a curriculum that maybe you didn't choose in your community. So it works as this wedge issue. But the problem is, what's happening is students aren't being taught. And in Indiana, this is a budgetary question for Pence, which is they don't want to pay to remediate students' financial aid as they enter college. So as these students enter, if they receive the Common Core diploma, the state of Indiana and other states are obligated to give financial aid to these students to proceed into college. But if they fail to meet those minimum standards to enter college, the state no longer wants to pay to remediate these students. So you're going to create this major problem in the state. What's going to happen is students are coming out of high school with what's called a Common Core diploma. So we're not even hitting those standards that at that moment. And then they're entering college and they're going to lose financial aid. And they're going to be stuck. You're creating an underclass in the state, all for Pence's political purpose.
John, what's your...
I don't believe that the federal government should become the national school board. I think those decisions should be made by the states, by the counties, and by the local school districts. I don't believe
that... Not even basic stuff.
No, I think at the state level, I think I would trust the school officials at the state level to understand what students should learn.
So
I don't think that should come from Washington, D.C.
A school administrator... In let's say, and again, I don't mean to pick on Mississippi, but we're going to pick a state.
Yeah.
A school administrator in Mississippi could say, "We're not going to teach about the civil rights movement, or we're not going to teach about, Martin Luther King, or we're not." I mean, you think that a school district supervisor should be able to eliminate that from a curriculum?
You could make the argument that maybe a school board in Rhode Island or in Massachusetts might not teach about the Reagan administration. That may happen.
It's true.
Does. And I am concerned about that. But I think it's much more dangerous to have a federal official making those decisions, because then you're going to have a straitjacket that all the states are going to have to abide by. And they're as prone to those political decisions.
But they're telling people what they should know, not what they...
Here's another point.
Art, sir, we got to hear from the professor. He's the ranking professor at the table, I believe.
Not necessarily.
I think so, Art.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce. I think that one reason educators are such a political football and whipping boy and girl is because they actually don't have that much heavyweight political clout, and they're an easy excuse, especially for politicians. I have a lot more faith in the local school boards in Massachusetts or in Mississippi. It's a traditional Republican theme, local government. I show my students lots of videos, generally older ones, the 1960 first Kennedy-Nixon debate. Nixon is remarkably prescient and impressive in different areas, including emphasizing, once you accept federal aid of any substance, of any large size, you are opening yourself to federal regulations, which you will regret. Wall Street Journal has had a very good series of articles dealing with this movement across the nation. It's not just Indiana.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. That was Art Sear. He is from Carthage College. Also with us this evening is Mark Acello. He is with the Calumet College of St. Joseph. And David Masiotra, blew it at the last minute, cultural critic from the Indianapolis Star, and John Kachelko joins us. We thank you all for being with us. This program is a Gen B production produced in association with WS Talk Radio. And our thanks to the ever-popular Todd Nebel and Dan Dorpin for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dubont. Good night from Chicago.